From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The coal was attacked in October of 2000. President Bush was running for office. He never mentioned it. Vice President Gore was running for office. He never mentioned it.
As the country focuses its attention on the 9/11 investigation, we take an in-depth look at another terrorist attack 11 months earlier, the USS Cole. In a Democracy Now! Exclusive, we speak with Anton Gunn, the brother of one of the 17 U.S. servicemen killed in the attack.
My name is Anton Gunn. My brother, Sharon Lewis Gunn, was killed aboard the USS Cole on October 12, 2000. This was the biggest miscarriage of justice related to terrorism in the history of the United States, and we want justice.
Then we go to Washington, D.C., where hundreds of demonstrators swarmed around top Bush advisor Karl Rove's house. And paying for your own surveillance? We'll see how international and U.S. students are refusing to pay a new university fee that funds a government tracking system to watch foreign students. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Massachusetts, the legislature has approved a state constitutional amendment that would ban gay marriage and create same-sex civil unions instead. Immediately after the vote, Governor Mitt Romney asked the state's highest court to issue a stay on its rulings that ordered the state to allow same-sex couples to marry beginning May 17th. Romney asked that the stay bar same-sex couples from marrying until after the proposed constitutional amendment could go before the voters. If it's approved by voters, the state's constitution banning gay marriage would go into effect in November 2006. Meanwhile, in New Mexico, the judge who issued a court order barring a county clerk from issuing same-sex marriage licenses recused himself from the case Monday, possibly clearing the way for more permits to be granted. Descendants of slaves filed a billion-dollar lawsuit Monday against Lloyd's of London, Fleet Boston, and R.J. Reynolds. The corporations are being accused of, quote, aiding and abetting the commission of genocide by financing and insuring the ships that delivered slaves to tobacco plantations in the United States. Discussions between the White House and 9/11 Commission are continuing over a compromise that would allow National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to testify in public. According to the Los Angeles Times, White House officials said Rice is willing to talk again to the commission privately, but she would not testify under oath. But the chair of the commission, Republican Thomas Kane, said, quote, "I would like to have her testimony under the penalty of perjury." It has also been proposed the commission be allowed to release their notes of Rice's first interview with the panel. There are no recordings of the questioning because the White House had barred the session from being taped. On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Charles Schumer of New York plan to introduce a formal resolution today calling on Rice to testify under oath. The New York Times points out today it's not unprecedented for a national security advisor to testify before Congress in open session. Jimmy Carter's Zbigniew Brzezinski did so in 1980, and Sandy Berger did so twice during his term as President Clinton's advisor. We reported this yesterday on Democracy Now! The Guardian of London's reporting the United States is planning to install an Iraqi prime minister and then transfer power to him on June 30th instead of the 25-member governing council. The Guardian also reports a three-person presidency with a Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish representative still being considered, but its powers would be mainly symbolic. The new chief U.S. weapons hunter in Iraq, Charles Dwelfer, is expected to tell lawmakers today his teams still have found no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But he said the search will continue. Meanwhile, the Iranian news agency Mirror has published a report suggesting U.S. may be planting such weapons in Iraq. The news agency cites an unnamed member of the Iraqi Governing Council who says U.S. forces have been quietly unloading parts for long-range missiles and weapons of mass destruction at ports in southern Iraq. Again, that according to the Iranian news agency Mirror. USA Today is reporting that in 2002, the U.S. pulled a team of special forces who specialized in the Middle East off of the hunt for Osama bin Laden so they could be sent to Iraq. They were replaced by troops with an expertise in Spanish culture. The report appeared one day after the Bush administration's former counterterrorism chief, Richard Clark, told Meet the Press, quote, "If we catch bin Laden this summer, which I expect, it's 2 years too late." He added, quote, "Because during those 2 years when forces were diverted to Iraq, Al-Qaeda has metamorphosized into a Hydra-headed organization with cells that are operating autonomously, like the cells that operated in Madrid recently." The Interpress Service is reporting that a former aide to President Bush, who now serves as the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, said in 2002 that a prime motive for the U.S. invasion of Iraq was to eliminate the threat Iraq posed to Israel. The comments of Philip Zelikow mark the first time a link has been publicly made by a member of the Bush administration between the invasion of Iraq and Israel. On September 10, 2002, Zelikow told a crowd at the University of Virginia, quote, "Why would Iraq attack America or use nuclear weapons against us? I'll tell you what I think the real threat is and actually has been since 1990. It's the threat against Israel," he said. He went on to say, quote, "And this is the threat that dare not speak its name because the Europeans don't care deeply about that threat, I will tell you frankly, and the American government doesn't want to lean too hard on it rhetorically because it's not a popular sell," unquote. At the time of his comment, Zelikow was serving on the influential president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, which reports directly to the president. Zelikow also is co-author of a book with National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice before she held that position and before he became head of the 9/11 Commission. The U.S. Army admitted Monday it had shot dead two Iraqi journalists with the Al Arabiya television network earlier this month near a roadblock in Baghdad. The Army claimed the killings were accidental and offered no apology. Meanwhile, the U.S. released a report Monday that found the worst friendly fire incident of the invasion of Iraq was triggered by a Marine air controller who mistakenly cleared Air Force attack planes to shoot at U.S. positions. 10 Marines died in the bombing. The California-based group Justice for New Americans is planning to hold a press conference today to demand the U.S. government issue a formal apology to Captain James Yee, who served as a chaplain at Guantanamo Bay. Last September, Yee was detained and jailed. Reports soon emerged he was going to be charged with espionage and aiding the enemy. He was held in solitary confinement for over 2 months. When charges were finally filed, the most serious was for illegally transferring classified documents as well as unrelated charges of downloading pornography and committing adultery. Last week, the government dropped all the criminal charges. Meanwhile, attorneys for Yee called on the Army to throw out the reprimand given to Yee related to the adultery and pornography charges. His lawyer said the proceedings were biased and a, quote, hoax by any standard. And in Uzbekistan, 40 people have died over the past 2 days. Half of the death toll came in a pair of suicide bombings on Monday.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been don't know what's up there beyond the sky. Oh, it's been a long time coming, but I know
Neville Brothers, Change is Going to Come, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The commission investigating the September 11th attacks last week wrapped up 2 days of high-profile hearings in Washington. The public hearings grabbed headlines across the country, continued to dominate the airwaves over the weekend as a political firestorm brewed over former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark's testimony and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice's refusal to give testimony under oath or in public. In the wake of the controversy over the handling of the war on terror by both the Clinton and Bush administrations, a lesser-known terrorist attack 11 months before 9/11 is once again in the news, the USS Cole. On October 12, 2000, a small boat filled with C4 explosives motored alongside a U.S. destroyer, the USS Cole, which was fueling up off the coast of Yemen. Two men aboard the small craft waved at the larger vessel, then blew themselves up. 17 U.S. sailors died. 39 others were seriously wounded. In an interview on Meet the Press last Sunday, NBC's Tim Russert questioned former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark about the Cole.
President Clinton did not bomb the al-Qaeda camps that you wanted, destroy them, did not respond after the Cole was attacked, 17 sailors killed.
Right.
And yet you're saying that he was more aggressive than President Bush?
Well, he did something, and President Bush did nothing prior to September 11th, so yeah. But let's talk about the Cole. The Cole was attacked in October of 2000. President Bush was running for office. He never mentioned it. Vice President Gore was running for office. He never mentioned it. The media hardly touched it. What were they focused on? They were focused on the election, and they were focused on the Middle East peace process. I thought it was a mistake, and the very fact that I quote Mike Sheehan in the book as saying that, I think is indicative of how he felt and how I felt. If I didn't think it was a mistake, that wouldn't be in the book. The facts have come out, and the facts have come out before the 9/11 Commission, that the FBI and the CIA refused to say who did it in October of 2000. And the president was therefore faced with the problem: can I go ahead and bomb somebody in retaliation for the attack on the Cole when my CIA director and my FBI director won't say who did it? Now, this is the same president who, when he bombed Afghanistan, when he bombed al-Qaeda camps, because George Tenet and I and Sandy Berger recommended he do it in order to get bin Laden and the leadership team where we thought they were going to be meeting, the reaction he faced to that was the so-called wag the dog phenomenon. No one in the media, Tim, no one in the media, no one in the Congress said, oh, that's a great thing that you're retaliating for the attack on the United States. They said, this is all about Monica Lewinsky, and this is all about your political problems. So now the same president who had that experience last time he fired cruise missiles at bin Laden wants to fire cruise missiles at bin Laden, but he's got a CIA director and an FBI director who won't say bin Laden did it, Mr. President. I would still have done it. I recommended doing it. Do I think it was a mistake that we didn't do it? Yes. But let's understand the context.
Former counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark on Meet the Press on Sunday discussing the reaction in the media and public to the USS Cole attack. Today in a Democracy Now! National exclusive, we're joined by Anton Gunn. He is the brother of Sharon Lewis Gunn, one of the 17 Americans killed aboard the Cole. He was 22 years old. Anton Gunn is executive director of South Carolina Fair Share, a nonpartisan membership organization made up of low and moderate income South Carolinians concerned with consumer and progressive social change issues. And we welcome Anton Gunn to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about your reaction over these weeks as the USS Cole is once again raised, attack that did not get a tremendous amount of attention when it happened?
Yeah, Amy, it got no attention whatsoever. And to hear it finally get some coverage in the news in terms of just mentioning what travesty took place on October 12, 2000, was very important to my family, and really feeling like we're finally getting the attention that the Cole attack deserved. I mean, it's been probably one of the biggest cover-ups that I could ever see about how no one just gave no attention, no credence, no response to what happened on October the 12th by any administration or any, you know, branch of the government in terms of what happened to my brother, his 16 shipmates, as well as the other 39 that were injured. I'm so glad that something is finally being said.
Can you talk about that day, how you learned of your brother's death, and then what happened after that?
Well, that morning, it was about 8 a.m. East Coast time when I first saw it come across the news as I was getting dressed that morning that a ship in the Middle East had exploded. And they didn't say it was attacked at that point. They just said there was an explosion aboard a Navy vessel. And I had a sinking feeling inside that something had happened because I had spoke to my brother by email a couple weeks before saying that they were heading towards the Persian Gulf. And I didn't find out that his ship was attacked until about noontime that I heard from CNN. Again, I found out more information from the news stations and from TV and radio than I heard from the entire military or the Navy. And it wasn't until 4 o'clock that afternoon that I found that my brother was one of the first that were listed as being killed aboard the USS Cole. And my family was devastated. I was here in South Carolina where I live and work, and my family, my brother and my family are all from Virginia, and they were all in Virginia, and so I was just, you know, devastated and alone. I had no one here with me but my wife, and in a frantic panic, I just jumped in the car and drove to Virginia to be with my mother, my father, and my brothers, and it was a very, very, very horrible day to literally find out nothing from the military, but just to hear my father calling me crying through the phone because he had just found out that his son was murdered.
What did the military tell you from that point on? We just heard Richard Clark saying how the CIA and the FBI refused to point the finger at al-Qaeda. What did you understand?
I understood exactly that after the Cole was bombed, you know, we were told very, very little. And, you know, we did hear from some military officials that they believed that al-Qaeda was behind this attack and this was Osama bin Laden's hand doing and all of those other things. They said that to us privately, but never, not once, not in, you know, 2 years after the Cole attack, was there any public acknowledgement that this attack was committed by al-Qaeda. I mean, for literally 2 years. And so we knew who was responsible because shortly after the Cole, Osama bin Laden produced a recruiting tape to recruit other men in the Middle East to join al-Qaeda. And on the tape, he says, "We thank God for the victory against the Cole and the sea," you know, a couple months ago. So he's saying this out publicly. But we can't get any accountability from anybody in the Navy, in the Department of Defense, or out of the White House, or anybody that said anything that says we know that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were responsible. They would not publicly say it. They would say it to us privately that, hey, we're investigating this because we assigned this to our New York field office, the FBI New York field office, which is the counterterrorism division. They deal with everything with Osama bin Laden. So they were investigating as this was a, you know, al-Qaeda-related attack, but they did not at one time, not for two entire years, did they publicly say that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were responsible for the attack aboard the USS Cole.
We're talking to Anton Gunn. He lost his brother, Sharon Lewis Gunn, in October of 2000. It was right before the elections. President Clinton was in office. Eventually, George W. Bush would take over. Was there a difference between the way the Clinton administration and the Bush administrations dealt with this?
No difference whatsoever. They both ignored us tremendously. They both did. It was just, you know, disgusting the way my family felt. I will say that in the moments in a couple days right after the Cole attack, you know, the president did the presidential thing, which is, you know, call the families and come meet with the families. We did share some time with President Clinton as he flew directly back from the Middle East to come directly and meet with the victims aboard the USS Cole, the family members. And so, you know, he did shed a tear and spend some time with us. But in terms of their response with an investigation, with just kind of, you know, letting us know what was happening, we heard nothing in the last 2 months of the Clinton administration, and we never heard anything the entire time during the Bush administration until, you know, most recently last February, where, you know, they called us for, you know, some meeting to give us some information. But
Anton Gunn, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. But when we come back, I want to ask you about one man. He was working in counterterrorism in the FBI, John O'Neill, and his role in attempting to investigate what had taken place and attempting to get at Saudi links. Eventually, he got so frustrated, he left the FBI, went to head security at the World Trade Center, and died on September 11th. We are talking to Anton Gunn, lost his brother in the USS Cole attack. We'll be back with him in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. We're talking to Anton Gunn, lost his brother, Sharon Lewis Gunn, on October 12, 2000, in the USS Cole attack. 17 U.S. servicemen died in that attack. Can you tell us, Anton Gunn, about the counterterrorism agent at the FBI, John O'Neill, and what he attempted to do?
John O'Neill attempted to do his job, basically, and he went above and beyond in terms of trying to outreach to the families and keep us informed and updated about the investigation and, you know, the avenues that he was trying to explore to identify the culprits that committed the attack aboard the USS Cole and to bring them to justice. I will say he was the only person in the FBI that made any kind of attempt to contact any of the family members. Mr. O'Neill stayed in very close contact with my father and called him regularly and gave my father his direct cell phone number, pager number, home phone number to speak with him directly about, you know, whatever my father had a concern about. And so, you know, he was very forthright. He was trying very, very hard. And I really didn't understand the whole dynamics of what he was having to deal with, but it just really felt like, you know, he was the lone wolf in trying to answer these questions and solve this investigation and bring things to light. And it just, you know, really made no sense to see, you know, an entire office with many agents and many lawyers and many other people that could be investigating the attack aboard the Cole, but the only one that actually seemed to be doing anything was John O'Neill.
What happened when John O'Neill attempted to go to Yemen in his confrontations with the U.S. ambassador, Barbara Bodine, who later became one of the Bush point people in Iraq when the U.S. first invaded?
Ambassador Bodine was being very obstinate, to say the least, in terms of allowing the investigation to go forward in Yemen. Again, I believe that there was a high level of political games being played in terms of how the investigation proceeded. Agents from the FBI, and I believe John O'Neill, went to Yemen several times wanting to interrogate suspects and talk to people in reference to what they saw on that day and what they knew about the individuals that carried out the attack. But the Yemen government were not forthright in cooperating. And Ambassador Bodine encouraged that lack of cooperation and really kept at bay the FBI and Mr. O'Neill and everybody else from actually doing their job. I mean, it was almost like, you know, she had to be the go-between. She had to be the gatekeeper that kept the FBI away from the Yemen investigators, away from the suspects that were being detained in Yemen. And she just made it very difficult for anybody to get any answers. I mean, the FBI agents wanted to ask questions to the suspects that they had in custody, but they couldn't meet with them. You know, they had to write their questions down on a piece of paper, hand them to Yemen investigators, and the Yemen investigators would take them into the room and ask the suspects the questions and then bring the answers back out written on a piece of paper. So there was no way for them to be able to ascertain body language or any kind of reaction to what questions were being asked. They really couldn't do their job. And, you know, that was just one of the many things that Ambassador Bodine put in place that just kind of kept, you know, the FBI at bay, that kept us at bay from really solving this crime.
We're talking to Anton Gunn, lost his brother in the USS Cole attack October 12, 2000, and looking at a piece in the New Yorker magazine called The Counter-Terrorist. John O'Neill was an FBI agent with an obsession, the growing threat of al-Qaeda. And in it, it says, after 2 months in Yemen, O'Neill came home feeling he was fighting the counterterrorism battle without support from his own government. He'd made some progress in gaining access to evidence, but so far the investigation had been a failure. Concerned about continuing threats against the remaining FBI investigators, he tried to return in January 2001. Bodine denied his application to reenter the country. She refuses to discuss that decision. The reporter writes, "Too much is being made of John O'Neill's being in Yemen or not," she told me. John O'Neill did not discover al-Qaeda. He did not discover Osama bin Laden. So the idea that John or his people or the FBI were somehow barred from doing their job is insulting to the U.S. government, which was working on al-Qaeda before John ever showed up. "This is all my embassy did for 10 months. This, again, quoting Ambassador Barbara Bodine. She said, "The fact that not every single thing John O'Neill asked for was appropriate or possible does not mean we did not support the investigation." After O'Neill's departure, the remaining agents, feeling increasingly vulnerable, retreated to the American embassy in the capital of Yemen. In June, the Yemeni authorities arrested 8 men who they said were part of a plot to blow up the embassy. New threats against the FBI followed, and Louis Free, acting upon O'Neill's recommendation, withdrew the team entirely. Its members, he told me, were the highest target during that period. Bodine calls the pullout unconscionable. Those men that were arrested, they escaped, is that right?
Yes. They all escaped at the same time, on the same day, the same way, in broad daylight.
And what do you think happened there?
Well, I think it was very calculated. My personal opinion is that there has not been any truth-telling in terms of the level of involvement in the Yemen government for the USS Cole and any other terrorist-related activities in the area. I mean, there's, you know, countless stories that I've found, I've heard about, you know, Yemen being a very, very, you know, terrorist-sympathizing country in terms of officials within the government atmosphere. And so to have 10 suspects or 8 or 10 suspects in custody, in prison for investigating them for terrorist-related activities, and all of them to escape together through a bathroom out of a prison and then get into taxi cabs and disappear into the northern regions of Yemen is unconscionable. And I really think that, you know, there was too much given in the area of, you know, responsibility to the Yemen government that they were doing their part. And we don't believe that they were doing their part. They never issued us a formal apology for what happened on their soil. They seemed to not be cooperating fully with the investigation, but for whatever reason, we were bending over backwards, allowing them to carry on the way that they saw fit and not the way that we thought was fit in order to truly investigate an attack that took the lives of 17 U.S. American sailors.
In that piece in The New Yorker, it talks about the connections between September 11th and the USS Cole. It says, a month after the investigation began, Assistant Director Dale Watson told the Washington Post, sustained cooperation with the Yemenis has enabled the FBI to further reduce its in-country presence. The same day, the Yemeni Prime Minister told the Washington Post that no link had been discovered between the Cole bombers and al-Qaeda. The statement was premature, to say the least. In fact, it's possible some of the planning for the Cole bombing and the September 11th attacks took place simultaneously. It's now believed at least two of the suspected conspirators in the Cole bombing had attended a meeting of alleged bin Laden associates in Malaysia in January 2000. Under CIA pressure, Malaysian authorities had conducted a surveillance of the gathering, turning up a number of faces, but in the absence of wiretaps, nothing of what was said. It didn't seem like much at the time, a Clinton administration official said. None of the faces showed up in our own files. Early last year, the FBI targeted the men who were present at the Malaysia meeting as potential terrorists. Two of them were subsequently identified as hijackers in the September 11th attacks. Jeez. We're talking to Anton Gunn, who lost his brother in the October 12, 2000 USS Cole attack. What about where your brother was buried and the ceremonies that have since been performed and your family's involvement?
My brother was buried in Arlington National Cemetery, and he was buried alongside with two of his shipmates. And there have been ceremony after ceremony in Virginia, not necessarily in Arlington, Virginia, but in Norfolk, Virginia, where my brother's ship originally ported out of. They've had ceremonies annually about, you know, they want to remember the victims of the USS Cole. But all of these have been done, you know, in the absence of the family. You know, they don't make any contact with us. They don't communicate with us about anything. All of a sudden we hear they're having some ceremony to remember the victims of the USS Cole, but no family members are included. You know, they've made promises to us, and, you know, huge promises in terms of, you know, when the Cole happened, America poured out and, you know, donated all kinds of money. You know, Faith Hill and Tim McGraw had a country music concert and raised some $400,000 for our families, the victims of the USS Cole. None of this money we actually ever saw because the military and the government decided what they were going to do with it. One of the things they decided is that every year for the next 21 years after the Cole attack, that they would place flowers and wreaths upon the graves of every person that lost their life aboard the USS Cole tragedy. Well, the first year after they made this promise to us, we went to Arlington on October the 12th. And there was no flowers or any kind of wreath, you know, honoring my brother or his shipmates on their graves. It happened twice out of the 3 years since the USS Cole attack that there has been no wreath laying ceremony or anything for the sailors that lost their lives. I mean, it's almost kind of like, you know, you want to tell the public that you're honoring and respecting and remembering the victims of the USS Cole, but you don't include their families, you don't talk to their families. You haven't given any information and support to their families. It's kind of like you're doing your own thing to cover your behind to say that you support, you know, your sailors and your troops. But, you know, in reality, you're doing nothing to support them other than cause them more and more anguish because you have refused to include them and communicate to them about your investigation, about, you know, what actually happened on that day, and truly just giving the family some closure. They refuse to do that.
Anton Gunn, has your family gotten any kind of compensation on the death of Sharon?
Other than the initial $6,000 burial benefit that all loved ones receive when they lose someone in the military, very, very little. I mean, and that's one of the major concerns that we've had for years is that, you know, we want to be treated as every other al-Qaeda victim has been treated. I mean, on September 11th, you had lots of numbers of people that lost their lives in the World Trade Center, as well as the Pentagon, that have all been allowed to be given redress in terms of the September 11th fund and access to compensation. But our families have been excluded. And, you know, we've talked and we were blue in the face. We've communicated with all levels of government and our elected officials about this issue. And, you know, we've kind of been ignored. I mean, we've truly been ignored as if this was something totally different from what happened on September 11th. And, you know, our families say that, you know, we were all victims of al-Qaeda terrorism. We were all let down by our military. We were all let down by our government. We were all let down by our elected leadership of this country. And the only difference between 9/11 and October the 12th is 1 year, 1 month, and 1 day. There's no difference, no other difference. And so we expect and should be treated as September 11 victims have been treated, but we have yet to receive any access to compensation for what happened to our loved ones or how we are able to deal with this situation.
There's a book called Forbidden Truth by French journalists and Frenchmen who worked with the Secret Service in France investigating Al-Qaeda. And in it, they also talk about John O'Neill and say that he felt most thwarted in his attempts to investigate any terror links to Saudi Arabia, which is why he ultimately left the FBI and went to work at security at World Trade Center and died on September 11th. The Yemeni president, about a month after the attack on the USS Cole, said that the small boat that was used to attack the Cole had been bought in Saudi Arabia and that at least one of the attackers was a Saudi citizen. Do you understand this to be the case?
Yes, very much so. And, you know, it's, the entire thing has been frustrating from the lack of information that we've officially gotten. And, you know, we've all done our own investigation. I know many family members communicate daily and weekly with folks in Yemen trying to get some answers, and we understand exactly that the boat that was used in the attack aboard the USS Cole was purchased in Saudi Arabia and then, you know, driven or shipped to Yemen in some capacity, and it was used in the attack. First, the attempted attack aboard the USS Sullivan in January of 2000, which was failed because they had too many explosives on the boat, so it sank. But they salvaged the same boat out of the harbor, put a new motor on it, then lined it with Syntex or C4 explosive and used it in the Cole attack. And yes, it was purchased in Saudi Arabia.
At this point, is any further investigation being opened into the attack on the USS Cole? And what kind of interactions have you had with government officials in demanding information?
Well, Amy, since the beginning of this endeavor or this event that changed my family life forever, I've attempted to contact the FBI on numerous occasions, beginning back in January of 2001. And I didn't hear any contact from anybody in the United States government or the FBI until, you know, September of 2001, where they said, oh, you know, the Cole is related to 9/11. And then we didn't hear anything again for another year. So it's been a terrible, terrible miscommunication and lack of communication on the part of the FBI into the investigation. And so this has really been 4 years, and I can say probably the 4 years coming up on the fourth anniversary of the Cole, I've probably talked to the FBI for maybe 12 months of that time frame and been ignored the rest of the time frame. But I do understand that there is an investigation that's continuing, that we were able to meet with Mr. Ashcroft sometime last February in terms of them announcing an indictment that they did have a couple of suspects that they had officially named as being related to the attack on the USS Cole. And they were all Al-Qaeda members, and they also named Al-Qaeda as a part of that indictment. That took some 3 years after the Cole attack officially happened for them to do that. But we do understand that there's a continuing investigation, and they're trying to, you know, put together the pieces. And, you know, we've been said to countless times by members of the FBI that they looked at the USS the attack on the USS Cole as a blueprint for what happened in 9/11, and that everything from their 9/11 investigation have been informed by what happened aboard the USS Cole, and therefore they are continuing to investigate to put together all of the pieces. So, you know, they're investigating, but, you know, it's been almost a year since I've heard anything from them, other than maybe a brief email to say that, hey, somebody's escaped, or, you know, they think they may have somebody else. But it's all, you know, our investigation, the family's investigation, we find our stuff out through the Internet and through news programs as yours that really try to tell the truth, because we can't get it from the FBI or from anyone in the government.
Anton Gunn, do you think if a full investigation had been done of the USS Cole, that perhaps September 11th would not have happened, the attacks?
There is no doubt in my mind. If the USS Cole attack was fully investigated, which means that, you know, ambassadors like Bodine would step out of the way and allow us to do our jobs, and if we were being cooperative as agencies with each other to fully investigate what happened aboard the USS Cole, there's no doubt in my mind that 9/11 could have been fully thwarted at a minimum, and that they could have, you know, really stopped many other terrorist plots that are in the making, that are being planned as we speak. But, you know, it was 9/11 was allowed to happen because we refused to do our job. We had no leadership that wanted to do a job. President Clinton said, listen, I'm trying to get out of office. And so he was trying to close up everything that he was doing so he could get out of office. And then when Bush got in, he was like, it didn't happen on my watch, so I'm not really worried about it. And that's how we felt for so many years. And we just kept saying, if you don't do something, if you don't, you know, answer these questions, if you don't investigate this, this will happen again. And 11 months later, September 11th happened. And there was no doubt the day when I saw those buildings on fire that I knew what had happened.
Finally, what you're calling for now, Anton Gunn?
I'm calling for some truth-telling. I want a clear and open investigation. I want Condoleezza Rice on the carpet to tell what she knows about 9/11, what she knows about the USS Cole, and every other elected official. Bill Cohen as well needs to be open and upright about what happened. So we want some truth-telling in terms of what happened aboard the USS Cole, and then we want our families to be treated equally as victims of Al-Qaeda. We want access to compensation just as everyone else has had. You know, you don't understand the tragedy of what terrorism can do to you and your family until you live it. And I don't want anyone else to deal with what my family has dealt with over these last 4 years. And so we want to be treated equally as all other victims of Al-Qaeda terrorist attacks have been treated, and give us our just due, our respect, and treat us fairly.
Have you sued the U.S. government for compensation?
No, we're in process of figuring that out because, you know, you hear people say, oh, you can't sue the government, you can't sue the government. But, you know, we have retained counsel and are in the process of looking at our options. We felt like that this wasn't necessary, that if they would just treat us all as equals, and just as they've allowed the families in the Pentagon and the families in the World Trade Center to receive compensation for what happened to their loved ones, you know, we thought that if we were able to get access and the same kind of support services that they received, then there was no need to file a lawsuit. But, you know, we've since reconsidered that just because of how we've been ignored for so much in terms of this complaint and this question about fairness and equity for all victims of Al-Qaeda terror. So that is a possibility. But, you know, again, where that success goes or what actually happens is, you know, your guess is as good as mine, but I really think it's unnecessary for us to have to go to those lengths to actually get someone to treat us, you know, the way we should be treated for what has happened to our families and to our loved ones.
Anton Gunn, I want to thank you for being with us. Anton Gunn lost his brother, Sharon Lewis Gunn, on October 12th, 2000, in the attack on the USS Cole off the coast of Yemen. Anton Gunn is currently executive director of South Carolina Fair Share, a nonpartisan organization made up of low and moderate income people in South Carolina concerned with progressive social change. And I thank you for being with us. When we come back, we're going to find out why hundreds of people descended on the front lawn of Coral Grove, and then what students are doing around the country to protest a new charge that they face that involves tracking other students. Stay with us.
Para burlar la ley, perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón, me dicen el clandestino. Por no llevar papel, pa una ciudad del norte yo me fui a trabajar. Mi vida la dejé entre Ceuta y Gibraltar. Soy una raya en el mar, fantasma en la ciudad. Mi vida va prohibida, dice el
la autoridad. Solo voy con mi pena, sola va mi condena. Correré mi destino por no llevar papel. Perdido en el corazón de la grande Babilón. Me dicen el clandestino, yo soy el quiebra ley. Mano negra clandestina, peruano clandestino, africano clandestino, marihuana ilegal.
Mano Chao, clandestino, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A week after hundreds of thousands of demonstrators took to the streets to protest the first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, several hundred people protested in Washington, D.C. this weekend to call for educational opportunities for immigrants. The protesters took to the streets on Sunday afternoon, but they didn't march down Pennsylvania Avenue or the mall. Instead, they went to Karl Rove's house. Rove is President Bush's top political advisor, best known as the driving force behind Bush's taking of the presidency. Several hundred protesters arrived at Karl Rove's house in school buses on Sunday afternoon, calling for Bush to advocate the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors Act, known as DREAM. The bill would permit immigrants who've lived in the United States for at least 5 years to apply for legal resident status once they graduate from high school. We're joined now by Mira Palacios, who is co-chair of the National People's Action, a 33-year-old multiracial, ethnic, intergenerational, nonpartisan coalition of hundreds of local community organizations. She led the protest at Karl Rove's house and spoke to him. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for inviting me here.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you tell us what happened at Karl Rove's house?
Well, of course, I want to first say that we had invited Karl Rove's or a representative to come to our workshop that morning on immigrant rights. You know, we did several attempts. We sent letters. We talked to his secretary and just repeatedly said that he wasn't available. So we decided to go to his house and talk to him. And, of course, you know, he first opened the door and yelled, "Get out of my property," and then slammed the door and went back in and, I guess, called the police. And so during this time, we just kind of sing and us to see him, you know, chant and all that. Then the Secret Service arrived and they asked us to, you know, we asked, all we want is a meeting and then we'll leave. So he said, okay, he agreed to meet with the two of the co-chairs. You know, NPA has three co-chairs. And so Inez and I were the ones who were going to meet with him. So if you ask everybody to get on the buses and move around the corner, so we did that. And so we went, he opened his garage door, and we entered the garage, and then he closed the door behind us. There was a police officer there with us, too. And so he used, he just yelled on our faces, tell us that how dare we come to his house, that we had disturbed, you know, his two children that were there, was a 10-year-old and a 14-year-old. He said they were crying, and I told her it wasn't our intention to make cry, but you know, we have 65,000 students that graduate from high school. They wake up every morning with the reality they can't go to college, and that's disturbing to us. And so we try a civilized way of, you know, we play by the rules, and we couldn't give them as you didn't come to the workshop, so we can give you this message. So we had to come to you, because see, our organizations pay their own way. You know, we save money through the year to come to the capital to talk to the people who can impact, who can help us fix our problems, and they don't come. So we could not leave Washington, D.C. without giving him the message that we went there to give.
We're talking to Mira Palacios, who is one of the protesters who went to Karl Rove's home this weekend. Why did you target Karl Rove? How exactly is he related to the DREAM legislation?
Well, you know, the DREAM Act has 62 co-sponsors. So if it's brought down to the floor, it will pass. And we feel that Karl Rove, has a huge, has a part to advise the president to come publicly and support the DREAM Act and to call Senator Frist, the majority Senate leader, and ask him to bring it to the floor for a full Senate vote.
What do you hope to accomplish at this point? Where do you take this protest now?
Well, as MPA usually does, we come to our own states, each of us. It was, we have like 39 different states represented, and we just come locally and try to work at a local level, bringing our message here in Kansas. We are trying to get the in-state tuition passed that we will allow the students who reside on Kansas to pay in-state tuition instead of out-of-state tuition. So each of us go back home and try to work on continue to support this. So we held telephone conferences and we kind of decide what's the next strategy. And a lot of us, the next day, yesterday, we held briefings on the Senate and the House side, also addressing, the members of Congress to support not only this but other issues. We brought the People's Platform briefing, which was 9 different issues that we are working at MPA currently.
Amira Palacios, I want to thank you for being with us. Co-chair of the National People's Action took the protest to Karl Rove's home this weekend in Washington, D.C. As we look at another student issue right now, international students in the United States last year became the latest target of the Department of Homeland Security's widening hunt for so-called potential terrorists. A new monitoring system called SEVIS, the Student Exchange Visitor Information System, took full effect last August in colleges and universities around the country. Under the SEVIS program, foreign students are required to enter personal information into a computer-based system that's then cross-checked against other government databases by federal agents in Washington. But that's not all. Some universities have gone so far as to add an extra fee for foreign students to fund the SEVIS program. So not only are foreign students being watched, they're being charged for their own surveillance. Well, students across the country have taken direct grassroots action against the payment of the SEVIS fee. We're going to go first to University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where students are refusing to pay the $65 fee to the university. Joining us on the phone from Amherst is George Liu, an international PhD student from China, international organizer with the Graduate Employee Organization, a union of graduate employees, which is leading the protest against the SEVIS fee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. How are you doing?
It's good to have you with us. Is this fee levied just against the foreign students or against all students?
Well, it's levied against all foreign students and visitors who have F-1 or J-1 visas.
And can you talk about your protest, about the university's reaction to you refusing to pay it?
Well, the university sent out kind of threatening emails to urge people to pay for the fee. And some tellers in Bursa's office, where we pay our bill, kind of tell people in an intimidating way that, if you don't pay the fee, you will be withdrawn. And we are protesting at different levels. We are making it a public campaign. We think it's about the image of the public university. And we also having as many as people as possible to withhold this $65 fee as a protest against this discrimination.
In addition to George Leo, we're joined on the phone by Mike Quito, who is a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin, former co-president of the Teaching Assistants Association at the university, which led the successful campaign last year opposing international students' payment of the SEVIS fees. He's joining us from Community Station WORT in Madison. Can you talk about the protest on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus?
Certainly. Thank you. Yeah, it was an amazing event. We were in the middle of a really nasty contract dispute with the state of Wisconsin, and on April Fool's Day, international students received an email from the university informing them they'd be charged an extra $125 next year to pay for their own surveillance. And literally dozens of them emailed the university back to the effect of, "We understand that you Americans have this tradition of April Fool's Day, but this is simply not funny." And so on April 2nd, an additional email went out explaining to everyone that, no, in fact, it was the real policy. 20% of the members of our union are international graduate students, and so we certainly couldn't sit on the sidelines as this racist, xenophobic policy was shoved down their throats. So we marched on the administration building, had rallies, got on TV, local radio, and actually got a resolution passed by student government and the city council denouncing the actions. And after a month of intensive pressure, finally on May 7th, the chancellor announced that he had found the money to fund it without any resort to student fees.
George Leo at the University of Massachusetts, what kind of consequence do you face as a foreign student refusing to pay this SEVIS fee?
Well, right now we have already passed the due date to pay the university bill, and we are waiting for a warning letter or email which says by a certain date, if we don't pay in full amount, then those withholders will be withdrawn, administratively withdrawn. And 3 weeks after that, they will report this information to Homeland Security Department, and we might face to be deported.
Why are you taking this risk?
I'm sorry?
Why are you taking this risk?
Well, I don't want to graduate from a school which fosters this kind of discriminative and xenophobic atmosphere. I like UMass, I like it a lot, but I don't want it to become this kind of institution which discriminates international students.
And what about your response to the U.S. students who, in solidarity, are refusing to pay $65 out of their own fees in solidarity with your protest?
I really appreciate the support that we have received from U.S. students. They have shown, you know, really courage, and they have shown their ethics. They have shown great solidarity with international students. That was really helpful.
Finally, Mike Quito, the kind of support you've gotten on campus at University of Wisconsin?
Yeah, we were able to form a very broad-based coalition between the TA's union, undergraduate groups, student government, student clubs that were centered around international student issues, and came up with some amazing email lists, some wonderful on-the-ground contracts. I would encourage every grad employee union and every teacher's union on every campus that is imposing such a fee to get out and do the organizing and make sure that this sort of policy is stopped, because no TA union certainly can be strong without reaching out to international members.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Mike Quito, former co-president of the Teaching Assistants Association at the University of Wisconsin, and George Leo, international PhD student from China at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, will certainly follow this grassroots movement around the country and encourage people to go to our website at Democracy Now! Today. We will link to the other programs we have done on the SEVIS program. That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. On April 13th in New York, we launch our more than 70 city tour, the Exception to the Ruler's Book and Media Tour in New York. It will be at Cooper Union Great Hall. That's on April 13th. And you can get more information at our website, democracynow.org, and call WBAI, for which it'll be a fundraiser. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Peace and blessings manifest. with everything.